Morning on 88.1, I'm Tom Hall, and this is Maryland Morning. We begin with immigrants and education, and a look behind the scenes at Patterson High School in East Baltimore, where one-third of the students were born in foreign countries. Many of them have fled violence and oppression. I'm joined by Margot Harris, who heads the English for Speakers of Other Languages program at Patterson, and Liz Bowie, who profiles some of these remarkable young people in her Baltimore Sun series called Unsettled Journeys. Then, Fanon Hill on the work of the Youth Resiliency Institute and the African Drumming Ensemble that's helping to build trust between residents of Cherry Hill and the police. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus and Coloring Your Hair, a coloring book for grown-ups that lets you do just that. We'll start with the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. As I'm sure I need not remind you, tomorrow, Guy Fawkes Day. Isn't that right, Mr. Sterner?
Remember the 5th of November, yes.
There you go.
Yes.
And Nathan and I are going to be talking about Guy Fawkes on Monday here on Maryland Morning. Mr. Sterner happens to be an expert in Guy Fawkes. But turning to a much more serious topic now, we're going to start today with a look at a high school in East Baltimore that is grappling with the enormous challenge of educating young people who have come to Baltimore, in many cases because they're escaping war, gang violence, and a host of other traumatizing events. One-third of the students at Patterson High School come from foreign countries. They speak 24 different languages, and many of them carry deep scars of broken homes, broken dreams, and broken lives. Liz Bowie is the education reporter for the Baltimore Sun this week. She is profiling three of Patterson's students whose individual circumstances are rooted in different areas of the globe, but who all share tremendous challenges as they navigate life in a new country. The series is called Unsettled Journeys. She joins me this morning in Studio A, along with Margot Harris, who leads the English for Speakers of Other Languages department at Patterson. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning, Tom.
Good to have you here. So, Liz, two of the three stories in this series have appeared so far. You're going to profile a third student on Friday, and then it'll be in Sunday's paper. But so far, we've read about Narmeen Al-Elwathi, who is an Iraqi student who came to Baltimore through this incredibly circuitous path in the Middle East, and a young man who you profiled today in today's paper, Excel Estrada. Tell us a little bit about these two remarkable young people.
Narmeen and her family fled Baghdad in the middle of the night years ago. They drove to Syria. They fled because her father worked for the American government as a truck driver, and that opened up him to a lot of backlash. And so he was kidnapped at one point. The family home was firebombed in the middle of the night, and that's why they fled. They went to Syria, then back to Baghdad for a month to get their passports, and then to Turkey, and finally to the United States. And the story really details not the journey from Baghdad to Baltimore, but the journeys that we haven't heard very much about in the media, which is the journeys once they arrive in the countries they've decided to settle in. And Narmeen's troubles are really related to the trauma that she feels.
You write about the nightmares that she experiences regularly. I mean, you know, any of us who've been parents of teenagers know that being a teenager is just hard enough in general under the best circumstances. And then, you know, to go through adolescence with these incredible traumas already piled up in your young life is amazing. Excel Estrada is a young man from a small mountain town in Guatemala. Tell us a little bit about him.
Excel is kind of extraordinary because he's lived on his own for a long time since his mother left for the U.S. And he basically raised himself by working from about age 9 or 10 on. And he got here about 2 years ago, and he's very serious, a very serious academic student who's very determined to make it, but he has legal challenges ahead.
Right, so he is, as they say, an undocumented
He is one immigrant. Of those unauthorized teenagers we heard about coming a year or two ago.
Right, yeah. Right. So Margo Harris, you think about this population of students and your job to teach them, it just seems impossible. It's like, where do you possibly start not only teaching these students individually, but then integrating them into the life of Patterson High School? It's an 1,100 student body, and, you know, just under 400, about 372 are, you know, were born in foreign countries. Where do you start?
You start very slowly and very carefully. You try to integrate them by smiling and just welcoming them into the community. You pair them up with other students to help them through their day. And you counsel teachers to be patient. The language comes. The social language does come. It's the academics that are the challenge.
And the students are still coming, too. Liz writes in her stories that last year, in just 7 months in that school year, the city, citywide, not all at Patterson, but citywide, added 1,000 foreign-born students. So this is the flood is not abating by any means.
It seems to have slowed down a little bit. We had last year, of course, we had a flood. That's a great word to describe what happened. It was overwhelming. This year, they're trickling in a little more slowly.
What is your mandate in terms of these students and making sure they graduate if possible? And what are you, I mean, are your aspirations for these young people, you know, exactly the same as your aspirations for the American-born students?
Sure they are. Yeah. We expect them to succeed. We want them to succeed. And many of them do.
Can you give us a general idea of the number or the percentage of them who are able to graduate in 4 or perhaps an extra year or something?
It
like
always
that?
Takes an extra year. Mm-hmm. There's always that fifth year. Our top 10% do happen to be foreign-born. These kids work extremely hard.
The top 10% academic achievers in the school
tend to be foreign-born.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've had several valedictorians who were coming from other countries who English is their second language. They do work very, very hard. And frankly, just like all of our kids, they're over-tested and under-educated. I mean, we don't have time to do all the teaching that we really feel we need to do.
Yeah. So, Liz, you've been, you know, covering education for a long time now for The Sun. We hear about test scores. We hear about Race to the Top, No Child Left Behind, all these various programs. Recently, we were reading about the PARC tests, the Partnership Assessment Tests, in which Maryland students did pretty poorly. Is the pool of students that includes these foreign-born immigrants, they're taking the tests, and are they, you know, are they affecting the numbers, the percentage pass rates one way or the other for Maryland at large?
I don't think they're a large enough percentage of the population, test-taking population, to really have that much of a, make much of that difference. However, their test scores are way, way lower than their 20 and 30% low, fewer pass rate.
Well, if I may interject, when you concentrate them all in one school, it heavily impacts that school.
Right.
And schools are penalized for low test scores.
Right.
Which seems very backward to me.
So there's pressure on you as a faculty and your principal,
heavy,
et cetera.
Heavy pressure. Yeah,
yeah, yeah,
it's very stressful.
Liz, one of the most poignant things, I think, in this series so far, immigrants' rights groups often point to the importance of reuniting families, or at the very least, not separating families. And you talk about Excel and his mother. His mother left Guatemala, literally walked away from the family, the children, the husband, and then soon thereafter, the husband left and the father walked away from Excel and his siblings. But the fact that Excel has now been reunited with his mother because she was in Baltimore and after a circuitous thing, including being in a detention center in Texas for a while and then finally being sent here to Baltimore, it's not necessarily, oh, great, you know, Mom, I'm here. They're having trouble, aren't they?
They are, and this is really very, very common among the Latino community. There are many students I talk to who are having family issues. I mean, it's hard to be a teenager and get along with your own you know, even if you've been living in the house for your entire life, much less sort of.
And if you've been away from each other for eight or nine years,
and you don't really know who your mom is anymore. And so you come to the U.S. and suddenly you're living with this stranger.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
And Margot, folks who are critics of current immigration policy, the folks who say we should just ship everybody home and, you know, build a wall and just not do that. And one of the reasons they cite is that it costs so much to educate these children, to give them health care, to take care of these families who are, in many cases, undocumented. How do you respond to that? I mean, you're on the ground every day with these kids.
Well, I don't really believe that it actually costs that much more, especially when you're barely funding the schools that we have in place now. Our American kids aren't even seeing the benefits of the money that is out there. We need to support our urban youth. It's that simple. We need to invest in our schools. And I think I hope the governor is listening, because I think if you invest in urban youth and you support public education, you will bring money to the city.
And Liz, you wrote about this in the series. You talked to immigration experts in terms of the outlay of money that it costs to educate and to provide health care versus what it would cost if they were not educated.
Yes, and it does cost something to educate kids. Basically, what economists say is if they get to pretty well educated and they can get to college, they're actually contributing more to the economy than if they don't graduate from high school. So it's a pretty simple, you know, investment in a way.
Yeah, you're saying, you have one expert who says that if they drop out, it'll cost the government about $89,000 more in services than if they get a degree, in which they will contribute an estimate of about $105,000 more than they'll get in services.
Yeah. Right.
So it's an investment. People use that term, you know, politicians use that term, but there's an argument to say that that's really true. Margot, when you tell us very briefly about the young lady who Liz is going to profile in Friday's paper, Monique Ngomba, she comes from the Central African Republic. Not only doesn't speak English, she's almost not literate in her own language.
That is true. She speaks a language called Sango. There are not many people in this country who speak that language, let alone in the city. But I will tell you, she is blossoming. I think it's going to be an incredible story.
Well, this is a great series. So if you haven't read it, ladies and gentlemen, make sure you pick up the paper or go online and get it. So Margot Harris and Liz Bowie, thank you so much for your time and for the series, Liz. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having us.
Margot Harris is on the faculty of Patterson High School in East Baltimore, where she heads the English for Speakers of Other Languages program. Liz Bowie is the education reporter, for the Baltimore Sun. The first two parts of her series, Unsettled Journeys, appeared online and in last Sunday's paper and today's paper. The final part of the series will be posted online on Friday. Photojournalist Amy Davis contributed some wonderful pictures and a very compelling video. We'll have a link to the series at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And as I said, you really got to make sure you check it out. Coming up after the news, a community artist searches for the beat that will change the dynamic between the police and the residents of Cherry Hill. First, we send it back to a guy who never misses a beat, Nathan Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The Youth Resiliency Institute works with African-American children and adults, primarily in Cherry Hill and Albemarle Square. One of its programs is called the Journey Project. It focuses on family engagement to help kids improve their performance in school. Fanon Hill is the executive director and co-founder of the Youth Resiliency Institute. The Journey Project includes an African-American family drumming group. Jerry Mayo is here with us, along with his 10-year-old son, Jeremiah. They live in Cherry Hill, and they've been drumming with the group. For how long have you all been drumming?
About 5 months.
5 months. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we welcome you both to the program. Glad you're here. And Mosiah Celine is here, too. He's an acclaimed drummer. He's won Grammy Awards. He's played with all sorts of people all over the world, and he's been teaching drumming in the Journey Project. Mosiah Celine, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Fanon Hill, talk about what the Youth Resiliency Institute does.
Well, the Youth Resiliency Institute provides a culturally relevant rites of passage process for children, youth, and adults in Cherry Hill, obviously Cherry Hill Public Homes, Albemarle Square, and we recently expanded into East Cleveland, Ohio. We were very fortunate in having secured funding from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation in 2014 to forward family engagement activities in those respective communities. So
Kellogg gave you $500,000. That's a chunk of change.
It is.
How'd you end up in Baltimore and Ohio?
Great question.
How's that go?
Well, we actually partner with the National Rites of Passage Institute in East Cleveland, Ohio. I am from East Cleveland, Ohio, and I wanted to provide an opportunity for families in Baltimore and families in East Cleveland to bridge gaps that exist and to really explore what are known as protective factors or promotive factors that allow black families living in low-income communities to overcome oppressive inequities and challenging predicaments.
And one of the real fundaments of your approach is this, what you call the rite of passage.
Correct.
So you're talking about kids, you know, going from teenage years into adulthood. A lot of people, they take those years and they just run screaming and kicking. They say, oh,
that's
too scary.
That's right.
I can't handle that. But you're saying that's a really important moment in a young man's or a young woman's life.
Correct. As well as in senior citizens' lives. My father is going to be turning 70 November 6th. And in terms of adults moving into elderhood, them being prepared for that phase of their lives. So seasons change in life. And in our lives as humans, as people, we go through phases as well. So rites of passage provides a process, a support system, a parachute as individuals are going through the ups and downs of life.
One of the emphases that you've had with the Journey Project, and particularly even with the Drumming Project, is the relationship between the police and the community in Cherry Hill. So are you specifically working to improve that relationship?
July 2014, I had an opportunity to present at the White House about our work in Baltimore City. And about a month later, while I was in Cherry Hill taking a journalist who was new to Baltimore City on a tour of Cherry Hill, I was followed by a patrol car, and I shared with the journalist that we were going to be stopped. And so after about six blocks, we indeed were stopped in front of the Cherry Hill Rec Center where we provide programming. And the police officer got out of his patrol car, and he was very aggressive. And the fact that the journalist, it was summertime, of course, by the time the journalist got out of his side of the car and his press credentials slid out of his shirt, the whole tone of the police officer shifted. And what's most remarkable about that experience is the fact that there were Journey Project families who witnessed this encounter and shared that this specific officer had a history of intimidating residents in Cherry Hill Public Homes. And so we recognize that when speaking about family engagement, police intimidation actually impedes healthy child and community development. And so we wanted to be proactive. Our style of family engagement is about being proactive and developing relationships with institutional structures as well as individuals. So we organized and we actually traveled to a Southern District and attended a community police relations meeting. And there we witnessed the class 1404 from the Baltimore City Police Academy. And there were young people, cadets, who were not much older than many of the family members in the Journey Project, their children. And so at that point, we generated an idea. What if we went upstream? What if we actually developed a relationship with cadets from the Baltimore City Police Department, providing them with an opportunity to learn about the families in the communities that they will be, you know, patrolling in, policing in? And so we actually had an engagement December 6, 2014, and over 20 cadets from Class 1404 engaged in an art workshop with our families. And so we are organizing presently to augment, to expand that engagement throughout Baltimore City.
Yeah, using the arts. So Mr. Mayo, you have lived in Cherry Hill for about 8 years. Is that your personal experience as well? What is your take and your perspective on the relationship between the police and the folks who live in the Cherry Hill homes where you live?
When I walked around the neighborhood and they looked at me like I was a suspect or something, and that I didn't have nothing to do with anything. They stopped, they looked at me and pulled me up and asked where I was going.
And this happens all the time?
Not all the time, some of the time.
But what do you think the answer is? What do you think is going to take for the police to be more trusting of the community and for the community to be more trusting of the police?
My thought is that it got to take trust. You know, you got to let people walk on by and do what they got to do before the police prevent you of asking, what are you doing?
Right. And Jeremiah, you're 10 years old. When you see a police officer, do you assume that that police officer is going to be, you know, able to help you, or do you get a little afraid of seeing a police officer?
I think they will help me in something.
You think they might be able to help you?
Yeah.
And do you think most of your friends think, you know, the police are there, that, you know, to make sure that people are safe and everything's going okay in Cherry Hill?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Masai Celine, as a drummer, you're teaching folks to play music together. And how does that relate to, you know, this huge issue that is citywide, not just in Cherry Hill, but it's nationwide, this whole relationship between the police and the African-American community? When folks are drumming with you, what are they learning about?
The first thing they learn is to focus. And my drum builds self-esteem and awareness and respect through drumming. So I'm hoping that, you know, that can carry on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people are listening to each other.
Listening. And
yeah, to play music, you got to listen.
And
it's
that's why I
playing.
Said focus is the main objective about drumming, because you have to pay attention to what you're doing. And if you don't, then if I acquire to play a rhythm and somebody's not listening, then they're not going to play it correctly. So
You got to listen carefully.
Yeah.
Fanon Hill, you wrote a report in 2013 with a mutual friend of ours, Peter Brune, called Strong Art, Strong Youth. It was funded by the Deutsche Foundation, and this is a foundation that spends a lot of time really carefully thinking about their philanthropy, and they're very involved in the arts, as you have been as a community artist. I've asked this question of a number of artists, from classical musicians to theater artists to dancers to writers. What is it that the arts can do to address some of these deep-seated problems like trust and distrust between the police and the African-American community in places like Cherry Hill?
Wow, we need an entirely different show. We need longer time, much more time.
Fair enough.
But great question. You know, I like to say that art humanizes the dehumanized. And it definitely fills a void left barren by generational trauma. And whenever we're engaged in organizing through the Youth Resiliency Institute, we recognize and acknowledge that every individual whom we come in contact with has experienced some sort of trauma, whether community members, law enforcement, agents, elected officials, so on and so forth. And so art is an element, a factor that undergirds all of our philosophy and methodology within the Youth Resiliency Institute. In 2007, the Heinz Foundation released a report called the Cultural Responsive Arts Education Report, and it focused on the role that the cultural arts plays within boosting the academic achievement of children and youth, specifically children and youth of color, Black children and youth. And so we recognize the role that the art plays not only in community transformation, but also in increasing the academic performance of young people. So to be able to engage in art, whether it's drumming, graphic art, so on and so forth, with individuals, whether they be in law enforcement, elected officials, I think is very, very important. We actually have a representative from City Council President Jack Young's office, Liam Davis, who heard about the Cherry Hill Drummers and plays, practices with the Cherry Hill Drummers. So it also increases art that is civic engagement and provides the oxygen for individuals to tell their story.
Masai Celine, give me the age range of the folks who play. I mean, here's Jeremiah playing with his dad, Mr. Mayo. That's nice. We got children and adults, but it runs the gamut, it looks like.
Yes, when I started in a child development center, and the children were 4 years old up to, you know, 7, 8, and then the adults. I mean, it's no discrimination.
So
everybody.
So
can
you got
play.
All sorts. Did the police ever play with you?
Yes. One time I was at a school called LaMelle, and they had a police station in the school, which was kind of weird to me. So we were in the auditorium performing one day, and one of the officers came in, and he said, "Is there an extra drum?" I said, sure. So he came up on the stage and started playing with us, and I thought that was really cool.
I wonder if that's something you could do a little bit more in Cherry Hill. I mean, just to have people play together.
I'm trying now.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. And Mr. Mayo, you've been playing with the group for about 5 months, you said. What's your reaction to it? How has it affected things? It must be, first of all, a very nice thing for you to be able to do with your son.
Yeah, it's amazing because the drum, the know your culture of drumming, that's a good thing because that's something different I didn't know nothing about. So I get, you know, the rhythm in, and I get it in, you know, the way it's supposed to get in, then I can get adjust to it.
Yeah, and so when you talk about culture, you're talking about learning the rhythms and the traditions of the African musical and African drumming tradition.
Yes, right? Sir.
Yeah. And Fanon Hill, do you also work with African natives too?
We recognize the power of African immigrants and refugees, and when speaking about culture, the cultural tactics that they employ so as their children can succeed academically. So African immigrants and refugees are some of the most educated populations within the country. And so we've been working with immigrants and refugees from Africa for quite some time, specifically with the Kwe family from Togo, West Africa. And we provide a network and an opportunity for families, Black American families, to really explore ideas related to academic success as well as family engagement with Africans.
So, Jeremiah, when you learn about things that happen in Africa, both what's happening in Africa right now and what happened, you know, many years and many centuries before any of us were born, do you like knowing about that stuff?
Yeah.
Do you like playing drums?
Yeah.
Is it fun?
Mm-hmm.
What's the funnest part about it?
About you learn beats, and one day when you grow up, you'll play drums and be in marching bands.
A marching band, uh-huh. Have you thought about what you might end up doing when you're like a old guy like me?
Well, when I grow up, I'm going to be a police officer.
You want to be a police officer, uh-huh. That's nice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Messiah, maybe drumming can help folks literally play their way out of this kind of situation where folks are just hassling people for a whole bunch of reasons that are probably very difficult to identify specifically.
Well, it's working.
Yeah.
It has worked, and it's going to continue to work because if we all listen and pay attention, a lot of things will change.
It's a collective effort, and the fact that we launched programming with zero public and private funding, connecting with community artists, having future outlook has been something that has fueled the work that we do. And we're going to continue doing this work. The Kellogg Foundation investment really was right on time in terms of supporting the efforts that were already on the ground in one of Baltimore's most disinvested communities.
As we go out, Messiah Celine, Jerry Mayo, and Jeremiah Mayo, you guys have brought some African drums. You maybe play us a little.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. Fanon Hill is the executive director of the Youth Resiliency Institute. Cherry Hill residents and drummers Jerry Mayo and his son Jeremiah are here, along with drumming teacher Messiah Celine. You can catch a performance by the Journey Project African Family Drumming Group next Monday at City Hall at 4 o'clock. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Ahead on the program, coloring books. They're not just for kids anymore.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Andrea Pippins joins me in the studio. She's a designer and illustrator who teaches design at the Maryland Institute College of Art and writes a blog called Fly Girl. Next week, she's publishing a coloring book for grown-ups. It's called I Love My Hair, a coloring book of braids, coils, and doodle-doos. Andrea Pippins, it's great to meet you.
Thank you so much.
So describe this book for folks.
Well, this book is a dream project. A lot of my work in the past has always been covering hair. And basically, it's a coloring book to coloring illustrations and things that I just love to draw. So I'm a drawer I'm an illustrator, but giving people the opportunity to use my work as a baseline for their own creative expression.
And so hair has always been a thing for you. I mean, if you look at your blog, there's a lot of stuff about hair and stuff. So where did that come from?
Well, I started when I was in grad school. I had a thesis project called I Love My Hair, and it was a social campaign to encourage women of color, black women specifically, to go natural. So the idea of not using harsh chemicals to straighten their hair. So the campaign was basically just having affirmative messaging to go natural. And from there, my work kind of just springboarded into all of these different kinds of illustrations regarding hair. And I'm drawn to how elaborate braids can be, or the idea of an Afro being gravity defying. So it just became this theme throughout my work.
Yeah. And so you put it into a coloring book. First of all, this coloring book for adults, this is like a thing now,
isn't
it?
It's huge.
It's huge.
It's so huge.
The New Yorker magazine wrote a thing about somebody who did one about the secret garden, mm-hmm. And it sold 2 million copies.
Yes.
I mean, that's crazy.
So crazy. I think people in general, but, you know, adults right now are just really excited about using something tactile to have a form of creative expression. So, you know, we're always on our digital devices. We're in front of a computer screen all day. So having an opportunity to do something that's a little bit different and nostalgic, I think, is what's making this trend happen.
Yeah. So they're not just for little kids anymore.
No way.
And the designs that you've come up with in this really amazing book are certainly not something you'd want to let a 7-year-old loose on. I mean, you know, you could really do some really fun stuff. I mean, because some of them have text. Some of them are, you know, some of them are ahead of hair. Other things are, you know, just lots and lots of different designs. You do a lot of branding and design work for clients.
Yes.
Tell us about that kind of work.
My background, I've always worked when I was working professionally. I always worked as an in-house designer. I worked at Hallmark Cards. I worked at TV Land, Nick at Night, and learned a lot about branding. And it's something that I've always really was interested in. And so my client work usually is around logos, promotional materials, things that really relate to making this brand stand out.
So how does hair then get interpolated into branding for, you know, these various companies?
You know, it's funny because when I started posting a lot of my work on the blog, especially a lot of the hair pieces that I was doing, a lot of new brands like hair products, hair salons, hair magazines reached out to me about doing branding because they saw this illustration and seeing how I could incorporate that illustration into possibly a logo for their business. So
they found you.
Yes.
Because they say, here's a designer who's doing stuff that
exactly.
is in our industry.
Exactly.
Interesting. What are your concerns about people's perceptions of hair, particularly of African-American women? Is it the culture at large that you're trying to address, or is it black women themselves trying to get them sort of over, you know, barriers or concerns that they may harbor themselves?
I think the biggest issue still today is a beauty standard that is unattainable for a lot of people, and this lack of appreciation for different kinds of textures and hair and hairstyles. And I'm hoping that the book just encourages everyone to embrace their hair and just love it and see it as just something that's fun and can be transformative within a style.
Do you think norms of beauty and what is considered beautiful and what is considered a beautiful hairstyle, have they changed a lot, you know, in the last 10 years, 30 years?
I think so, because I went natural in 2001. Back then, it wasn't that long ago. But I didn't have a lot of resources when I was going natural. But now their resources are aplenty. And you go to Target or Walmart, you can find natural hair products for African-American hair, which is great. Just the way that it has bloomed in the last decade has
and
been phenomenal.
15 years ago, you couldn't find those
exactly,
products.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting, yeah. Because everybody expresses herself in a different way.
Absolutely.
So it's not like it's a bad thing necessarily if you choose to, you know, color your hair red or green or
exactly.
something. But you're saying that there's got to be options for people who want to do it.
Right, and have fun.
Yeah.
You know, hair is, it's a way to express style and to, you know, show your creative interest. It's another form of creative expression. So I just hope that people really have fun with their hair.
And is there a backlash, though, do you think? I mean, are there people who are saying, well, you know, you're not natural, you know, therefore you should be? Is it kind of like, you know, is it possible that the pendulum could swing the other way?
I hope not. I know that when I first went natural, I was a little radical with it,
mm-hmm.
Just really wanting people or, you know, women of color to just embrace their coils. But, you know, it's really to each its own. And I've really grown to understand how important it is to let people decide as an individual what they want to do and with their hair, with their bodies. in general.
You know, when we see pictures of people from the 60s, for example, mm-hmm. in the civil rights era, you know, people marching and stuff, the hairstyles were one thing. And then you see people in the 70s and the 80s, you know, hippies and all that stuff,
right.
and the hairstyles, you know, as things evolved later in the 20th century. When we look back, when you're an old woman, which is a long way from now, you know, when you look back at this period, the 2000s, the 2010s, what do you think the look is going to be that people, you know, your grandchildren are going to look and say, oh, Grandma, look how you guys wore your hair back then. What will be the signature look, do you think?
You know, I think it would still be the Afro. You know, it's a classic style, but the Afro of today is very different from the Afro of the 60s and 70s. I think there's a style called the twist out, which is my go-to, and it's just like a, I guess, more textured Afro, and I think that
yeah,
would...
So just, how do you do that? How do you get a twist out?
So
you got to work at it, or is it...
You just... do have to work at it. Uh-huh. So with my hair, actually, my hair is in twists right now, and it's taking just two small sections of hair and twisting it around each other, and then after a few days, letting it out, so untwisting it, and then it kind of gets bushier and bigger as the days move forward. So I think that would be the signature style for this natural hair movement of today.
The care of hair is oftentimes something that you share with your family.
It's an intimate moment when somebody has their hands in your hair, and just thinking about the relationships that people have with their stylists, you know, going to the salon and sharing intimate details about their lives and things that are happening. Or I remember my mom doing my hair on the weekends. That was our time to catch up on the week, what was happening, or just, you know, talk and have fun. So yeah, it's a very special time.
It's interesting because there are some women who, it seems to me at least, that change their hair dramatically, mm-hmm. like weekly, you know, or
yes.
monthly or something like that. I mean, what do you think that indicates?
I think that is someone who just doesn't take their hair too seriously, whether it's going really short or adding a really bold color. I think it's someone who's just looking to have fun and switching up their style a little bit.
So how do you create these images? Are these all hand-drawn?
This was a very different project for me in terms of creating the final piece, because typically I use design software to do my illustrations. But yes, this was all done by hand, and I scanned in each of the drawings and cleaned them up in a program called Photoshop to make sure there aren't any little eraser spots or ink blots. I did a ton of research to really kind of grasp the content.
I think this would be a very soothing thing. You're right about, you know, our reliance on our devices. You know, we're tapping away on our iPads and on our phones all the time. This is something you just get a pencil or a crayon or something.
And just sit,
know,
and,
yeah.
and you could take it anywhere you go.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's great to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Andrea Pippins, the new book is called I Love My Hair, A Coloring Book of Braids, Coils, and Doodle-Doos. It's published by Schwartz and Wade. It's available next Tuesday. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Join us on Friday when we'll start a new series we're producing in conjunction with our colleagues at the Baltimore Brew. It's called the Accountability Index. Till then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.